on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. We react to Joel Wolf, Roki Sasaki's agent, talking about the process upcoming for the Japanese pitching phenom and what his next steps could be towards coming to Major League Baseball. We'll talk about some more details involving the Juan Soto negotiations. And Nolan Arenado might be on the move. That and so much more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that demands a suite wherever we go. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And maybe we can use Juan Soto's.
Oh, man. We'll even take it discounted. You know what? I think that would be fine. As long as we have one, I think everything is going to be okay. On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, this winter meetings edition of Baseball Barbacast, it's Tuesday afternoon, and Juan Soto, as far as we know, is still going to be signing with the Mets at some point. We don't know when that is going to become official. We are going to talk a little bit about some more details that came out about the Soto negotiations, but we are going to begin with something that just happened here in Dallas. That was Roki Sasaki's agent, Joel Wolf, speaking about the Japanese right-hander who was officially posted for Major League teams to begin negotiating with. I believe that happened yesterday. Now that Roki Sasaki is a free agent, we finally have some information from his agent about how this process might play out. So let's begin, my dear friend Jake Mintz, with the opener.
Roki Sasaki will not be an opener. That feels pretty certain. He was officially posted this week, which means he now has a month to negotiate with MLB teams.
But of course, because of the rules involving him being considered an international amateur, assuming he does not sign until the next posting period opens, which, based on what Joel Wolf spoke about, which we'll get into, that will not begin until January 15th, which means that in all likelihood, his official decision, what time he will be signing, will be sometime between January 15th and January 23rd. But based on what Joel Wolf said, it's possible we will know which team he's leaning towards before then.
For those of you uninitiated with Roki Sasaki, the elevator pitch is very simple. He is a 23-year-old pitcher from Japan who is really freaking good. He has had some injury issues throughout his tenure in the NPB, but the ceiling is comically high, and he's going to come at a very low price because he is labeled as an international amateur.
Yes. And what did we learn? So I think Joel Wolf, who also represented Yoshinobu Yamamoto last year and Kodai Senga before that, he of course is very experienced in this space. And of course, we will talk a little bit about Scott Boras more later, but the reality is Joel Wolf is also in that inner circle of baseball agents. He has, of course, some of the other top players in the game, not just the top Japanese players. And so he kind of did this impromptu session at the winter meetings. It was, I mean, to our understanding, I don't know how much notice other writers got about this, but essentially he kind of walked in to the big media workroom and kind of gathered everyone around, because this is a situation where all 30 teams and all 30 beat writers and every market is interested in Roki Sasaki. And so Joel took questions for probably about 25 minutes. And what was the biggest thing that you would say you learned as he kind of talked through what the process is that is about to unfold?
If you're going to take Joel Wolf at his word, and I'm going to, because in my first interaction with him just now, he seemed like a likable gent. My biggest takeaway really has to do with the timeline. And that's because Joel Wolf, the agent, doesn't really know what Roki Sasaki wants yet, because they haven't sat down and communicated his preferences. And so when the members of the media were asking Joel, well, what does Roki think about this? Joel is basically like, I don't know. Like, he has not said that to me, so I cannot say that to you. And even if Joel Wolf knew what Roki wanted, I don't know if he would be telling all of us, understandably. But because of that, this is going to take some time, right? The meetings have not begun. The pitches are only just rolling in. And so Sasaki will have to flip through them. And because he is going to be courted by pretty much every team, it is likely to take the distance. He will not sign in 2024. he will sign in 2025.
Yeah. And again, just a little bit more on that timeline, because I would say that Joel Wolf did talk about, he did give some insight into Sasaki, the person, and some of the things, of course, that he's been through. And I think we should get into that a little bit too. But that timeline that we're talking about, if you're curious about when to expect, we're starting to hear about which teams are interested, which teams he's meeting with. He did say that that first round of meetings could be starting as soon as next week. It sounds like Sasaki is coming to the United States at some point this week. Joel said that he's planning on finally meeting. And now, to be clear, it's not like this is the first time he's met with Sasaki. He's represented him, I believe he said, for 2 years. So this is someone that he's worked with before, but he has not started the conversations about what he's interested in terms of the next step of his career. And so the way he described it was meetings could begin as soon as next week. That's likely not going to be visits, but meetings, perhaps in the same way that, you know, Juan Soto was holding his visits in Southern California at the Boris Corp. I don't know where that could be for Joel Wolf and Wasserman, but that is presumably going to happen somewhere in the United States. And then he also said that Sasaki is likely to return to Japan for the holidays. And then at some point after the new year, kind of go through a second round of meetings, which could potentially include visits to cities. So it's clearly going to be a thorough process. He said that the first piece of advice he would give to Sasaki, which is pretty cliche, but I think is important in this context, is to keep an open mind. And I think that is interesting, too, because this is a situation where I was kind of amused where Joel said that it was the same advice he gave to Yamamoto, right? And I believe him, and that makes sense. But that was a different situation because only so many teams were going to be in position to give Yamamoto anywhere close to what he was worth. Whereas in this case, another interesting takeaway was, will the difference between $5 million and $7 million and $9 million or $3 million or whatever teams are able to offer him from their international bonus pools, he was like, I would advise him to not necessarily, you know, take a short-term financial boon now, which is like, oh, let me just go to the team that's giving me $2 million more now, because this obviously, based on the decision to come now and not in 2 years when he could certainly cash in, is a choice that you are playing the long game. And so he is trying to set himself up for success right now, regardless of what that bonus ends up being. That doesn't mean he's going to sign for $5, but it just means that it maybe is not part of the equation that we should be focused on too much.
The other incredibly revealing moment was Joel Wolf's response to a question about why Sasaki is coming over now, why he is opting to leave such gobs of money on the table to make the leap at age 23, where if he waited until age 25, he would be a normal free agent like Yamamoto, where he could sign for as much money as he wanted. And my takeaway from what Joel said is that the Sasaki situation feels different than the Ohtani one. Even though the mechanics of it are identical, Ohtani was more, he had no worlds left to conquer in Japan. He had won a title. He had been the best player. He had pitched. He had hit. He had done it. And so there was something kind of, it was like, okay, this, I did this. I won this. I succeeded. I move on now. For Sasaki, it's more about living for today and taking advantage of the opportunity in front of him. And Joel said this, that's related to Sasaki's personal history, which is really tragic. He lost, I believe, his father and his grandmother in the tsunami in, I believe it was 2011. And because of that, he wants to live out his dream of playing in the US, playing in MLB. And he has the opportunity to do that now, and he could slip on a banana peel tomorrow and never pitch again. And so he wants to make the leap. And I think that that's going to inform his decision-making. The fact that he's making the decision at all will dictate where he ends up. How? We don't know yet.
Yeah, and I think that combination of his personal history, which of course includes that personal tragedy at a young age, and also, which Joel was also extremely transparent about, looking ahead and realizing the risks of pitchers, and him even knowing that, of course, it's easy for us to say, like, well, whatever, he could just sit on the couch and then sign for $200 million in 2 years. That might be true, that might not be. Realistically, if he continues to pitch in Japan and the injuries that he's had, like, who knows what status he would be in. I mean, you don't have to, it's not hard to find pitchers who's seemed to have incredibly promising careers that not that long later suddenly were not, right? Like that, it's not that hard to find examples of that. And so because of that, I think he is recognizing that right now, this is an opportunity where he still had a good season. And obviously, by the way, if you haven't, you know, listened to our interview with Yuri that we did a few weeks ago with so much more insight into Sasaki the player and his whole career, like go check that out. We don't have to review his whole career now, but he knows that this is still a next step. This is still an opportunity that he wants to do. And then he also talked about that, you know, it was a difficult process, of course, getting to even have the opportunity to be posted by his team at this stage as well. And I have to say that is one other part about this that was compelling because it came up multiple times, is that Joel spoke about how, and Yuri sort of touched on this, but I think it was interesting getting the perspective from someone who has spoken to Sasaki directly over these last couple of years, is that the media in Japan has been particularly harsh on him in the lead up to this potential decision to try and come to MLB, which everybody knew was going to happen at some point, but it was a matter of when. And him pushing for that and how that was kind of received in Japan specifically is something that was very difficult for him. And he was, again, Joel was extremely transparent talking about how, like, that was wearing on him mentally. Like, that was not a fun experience. And that was kind of parlayed into a point later where he talked about maybe it would be better for him to be playing in a smaller market. He also said he feels confident that he would be able to handle a bigger market. But the point is that media, the experience of the last 2 years was not pleasant for him. And it would be a different kind of thing if he was to sign in New York or Los Angeles or whatever. But I mean, I don't think that's nothing. I mean, it's if he still ends up signing with the Dodgers or the Yankees, I'm not going to be stunned. But I thought that was compelling, and it was a reminder of how many teams are going to enter into this situation feeling like they have a really good chance. And I think that is why this is going to be one of the more unique free agencies we've ever seen.
And this press conference was fascinating. Just to peel the curtain back a little bit, we're sitting in the media workroom. We hear a rumble in the corner, and I just jet over there because I'm an intrepid young man. And I just assumed this was going to be Scott Boras. And so I hollered back to Jordan, Scobo. Scobo.
No. And it was Jowo.
Jowo.
And we're not going to boot up the Jowo Scobo quite yet. But I was skeptical just because when Boras talks, there's always the backdrop. He's got like the fancy logo and that wasn't there. So it would have been a strange, like, we're obviously going to hear from Boras at some point here, especially if Soto goes official here on Tuesday. It was kind of a nice surprise since we had no idea what was going on.
And this is maybe a little bit behind the curtain, right? But if you're listening to this, you probably care. Like, Boras is a showman. And Boras is turning everything up to 11 and doing the bit and squeezing every last drop of drama and theater out of whatever he does. Joel Wolf was the opposite of this. It was a cannon blast of earnesty. It was very jarring. And it was clear that Joel was uncomfortable to, like, be up there in front of 75 people. Whereas when Boras is up there, like, he's got the smirk on his face and he's vamping and it's, you know, that's, he's in his bag. So I thought that was compelling to see Joel Wolf move in this space. And he opened it by saying, I'm very surprised by the amount of attention this is getting, to which I was like, Joel.
No. But see, I would push back on that a little bit because he, and I can't speak to how exactly this was arranged, but he also, I also think just have to give him credit where it's just like, this was appreciated. Like, he understood that now that he has been officially posted, this is the person who's representing him and is going to speak about the situation and can lay out, not just to necessarily tell us, because from the beginning, he said, I haven't spoken to him about potential fits yet, it's not about that. But for him to give us as many details about what this timeline could look like, for him to say, yeah, he technically could sign immediately, but we do not expect that to happen. I appreciated that. And I think a lot of people who are interested in this process, I think it was nice to kind of hear from the person who will be handling the negotiations. So I appreciate his honesty. I mean, the one part about this process that he did not touch on, which isn't really his responsibility, but the reality is if Sasaki is going to be signing for a large signing bonus in the next signing class, that could have ramifications beyond in terms of the players who have already agreed to deals. Now, that is a messy process that I imagine we're going to learn more about as January 15th approaches. It's not really Joel Wolf's problem, but it is a part of this story that we are going to have to keep an eye on. And I just want to mention that that was not really discussed in this scrum, and I understand why, but it is a part of this story that we're going to continue to be following closely and explaining a little bit more thoroughly when we get there. All right, Jake, let's take a quick break. And when we return, more details involving the Juan Soto negotiations and Nolan Arenado. Sounds like he's going to get traded. We'll be right back on this floor.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast, Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. I have one dumb question for you, my friend. Did it really matter that the New York Yankees were not willing to give Juan Soto his own suite?
What are we talking about before I answer that? John Heyman for the New York Post delivering some very interesting details regarding the final stages of the Juan Soto pursuit involving Mets owner Steve Cohen, who spoke about this. And there were a few details that were particularly revealing, including the one that you just shared. Before I get to the suite, the main takeaway regarding Heyman's reporting here is that Steve Cohen, up until late Sunday or middle of Sunday, was still feeling like he's probably going back to the Yankees. There's him talking about, like, they're the Yankees, they have Aaron Judge, like, you know, I'm doing my best, I'm doing my thing. I mean, he has this quote in here, quote from Cohen, "I was being logical. When you have Judge, it's tough to beat that." And this, again, honesty from Cohen, I don't really know what his benefit would be lying about these feelings leading up to the end of it, even if he always knew he probably was going to give the highest offer. That it then comes down to some of these other details involving these offers. And the most interesting one, literally the most juicy one, is the idea or the detail here that, as we know, we mentioned it because we got it when we first talked about Soto, that the Yankees were willing to offer $760 million over 16 years. They were not willing to offer a suite. Now, what does a suite mean? This is a thing that you do hear in other contracts. This is not just the Yankees or Dodgers or whatever. Like, you do hear this sometimes, like big free agents. It's like, all right, cool. You just have a suite that you can just use whenever you want for all the home games. That's just yours. And there's this detail here that they didn't feel like they could give one to Juan Soto when Aaron Judge and even Derek Jeter before that paid for theirs. And here it says they were willing to discount a suite, but not after their precedent. So, and then it says Cohen didn't give the suite much of a thought. So he's like, yeah, sure, take one of our suites, whatever. My question to you is this about the money that you are not making by Juan Soto having his own suite, or is it about the precedent involving Aaron Judge and Derek Jeter?
Is it Yankeedom getting in the way? Like, the Yankees refused to offer the suite. It has nothing to do with money. Right? It's because they didn't want to insult Judge or Jeter. And I get that. I get the idea that Juan Soto is not above those guys. But guess what? He is. Because you're going to give him a lot of money. More money. Double the money. Right? Did it matter? Yeah.
I mean, it's in this story for a reason. I don't know if we are to take this as a part of Soto's perspective, then it feels like this isn't Steve Cohen saying, yeah, we got him because I offered him a suite. That is not what this says, right? The way this reads as this was something that was, again, I have a hard time believing that this was the number one thing, but you're trying to come, when you get to the numbers at this point, we're looking for other reasons. Right? We're looking for other details. We're looking for other things that could have pushed Juan Soto in different directions, because the Yankees were offering $760 million. You know, we wouldn't be talking about
that's
this.
That's not disrespect.
Yeah.
It's hard to see it as disrespect, because it's not as if they were just like, yeah, we'll give you $400 million and no suite. Like, it wasn't an insulting offer. I think It is such a perfect nugget, though, because you have to find a way to differentiate these two teams and look at why Juan picked one over the other. And I believe that it's mostly money, but there are some of these softer factors that seem to have been a non-zero level of import.
Yeah. And again, I mean, beyond that, you know, we have some more reporting in here about, okay, the Blue Jays were also offering over nearly $760 million. And, you know, when the money went up by another 10 and 5 and whatever. But I think at the very least, I am compelled by the notion that Steve Cohen was not, because we all understood that, like, okay, he would not be denied. But him being like, yeah, obviously I was going to bid the most, but I didn't know if it was going to work. And the fact that it still felt like the Yankees were clearly in a strong position, then it does make you wonder, like, what were those small things at the end that tilted it? And maybe it was just the fact that they ended up offering him more, you know, 51 a year instead of 47 a year. You know, like, that's fine. That's a lot of money. That's good for Juan Soto. And if he wanted to make the mark and, the, you know, get it to the very top of the scale to set a place for future super duper stars hitting free agency at 26 to shoot for, then, you know, God bless him. But, you know, it's definitely a detail that is interesting, and I'm sure that we'll probably be getting some more in the coming weeks. And I think that's a good place to leave it. This is still not official yet. Yesterday, Carlos Mendoza was asked about this, and he had to pretend like he didn't know who Juan Soto was. That's very goofy. Those clips are funny. Again, that's just kind of how this works. I assume he will be taking his physical and it'll be official at some point soon. Will we see him here in Dallas? I don't know. But I imagine there will be at least one more round once he does the press conference of questions and answers where we will learn a little bit more about how this went down.
I don't really have much else to say about Juan Soto. Just kidding. I have everything else to say about Juan Soto. We did an entire podcast about Juan the other day. And we did not say the name of the general manager of the New York Mets, David Stearns. And I think that as we get more reporting, that decision on our part or our failure to talk about David Stearns feels like a miss. Because if other non-financial factors played a role, that has to do with Stearns, who's the president of baseball operations, selling the future of the team to Juan Soto and convincing him that they're going to be good. And with the way that Stearns carried himself in that room seems to have pushed the needle a little bit in a positive direction for Soto. And so I just want to say, David Stearns, I'm sorry.
Yeah. And I imagine there has to be some element of, okay, who do I know, you know, Jeff Passan had a quote when he was first reacting to this, that they kind of made some waves talking about how, like, oh, well, if the offers were close, then the Mets, you know, Juan Soto saw the future as brighter with the Mets than with the Yankees. Maybe that's a commentary on David Stearns. Maybe it's not. Ultimately, are we looking too deep into it? Who knows? But David Stearns, like, it is funny. Like, I am just laughing at the concept of David Stearns up there at the presser and asking David Stearns, David, what did you like about Juan Soto? What did you like about Juan Soto as a player? What made him an interesting? Sorry.
Why do you guys zero in on him as someone who you think could help your ball club?
Because I think this was announced, and I don't know if he's already spoken on it. I would love to know that answer for, like, why he thinks Clay Holmes can be a starter. To get that. That's fascinating. But I think it's hilarious to ask him the same question about explain why Juan Soto. What's so great about him?
So that's the sweet life of Juan and Soto. We'll talk about him 1,000 more times, I'm sure.
Yeah, we will. Let's talk about the other kind of buzziest, not quite news yet, although it is related to our first topic, and that is Joel Wolf, as I mentioned, he does not just have Japanese superstar pitchers. He has some of the best players in Major League Baseball born in these here United States.
And Nolan Arenado.
Oh!
Yikes. Disrespectful.
Nolan Arenado, his agent is Joel Wolf, and Nolan Arenado, from what we can tell now, is in a very likely position to be traded. Now, why is Joel Wolf involved with a trade? That is because Nolan Arenado has a no-trade clause, and there is precedent for this, which is basically when a player has a no-trade clause, which is something that was negotiated by Joel Wolf, as we know. And the team is wanting to trade Nolan Arenado, and the player is willing to be traded. That no trade clause means that he gets to say what teams he's willing to even bother with. And so that is part of Joel Wolf's job, is to make that communication to the Cardinals front office and say, these are the teams he's willing to go to. These are the teams whose phone calls you should return. Because otherwise, it's a complete waste of time for all the teams involved. If
right.
Joel Wolf is and Nolan Arenado have no interest in Nolan Arenado playing, you know, with the Rockies again, for example.
The Marlins, like, he doesn't want to play for the Marlins, so the Marlins are not going to call and spend time discussing a Nolan Arenado trade with the Cardinals. Here's what I will say about the Arenado situation. The overwhelming consensus is that he's getting traded, and that his desire to be traded stems from a pseudo promise made to him that the Cardinals were going to contend within the timeline of his contract. Remember, he opted in to the remainder of his deal for less money probably than he could have gotten on the open market, because he was happy in St. Louis and he thought that they were going to win. That has not been the case, and it does not seem that it is going to be the case. And so it is completely fair, in my mind, for Arenado to want to be traded. And I would be shocked, floored, flabbergasted even, if we got to February 1st and Nolan Arenado was still an employee of the St. Louis Cardinals.
We might not get to January 1st. It seems like this is something that is heavily tied to Alex Bregman's decision. Obviously, if you are interested in a third baseman and you want to spend money, that could be giving Alex Bregman $180 million. That could be taking on the rest of Nolan Arenado's contract, which I believe is another 3 years and over $70 million or so, which is expensive for a player that has clearly declined in recent years, but he is still a starting quality third baseman and someone that would make teams better. And so as for who those teams are that he is interested in playing for, I mean, it's easy. You could pull up the teams that have massive third base holes, and some of them are, you know, contenders like Houston as it stands, right? I think that would make a ton of sense as a pivot if Bregman does indeed go elsewhere. I mean, the Tigers, I guess, fit in that bucket as well if they are looking for a veteran presence and don't want to pitch. But again, it's like, how much money are you pitching in there? Then you have the Yankees, right, are the other obvious one that are going to come up in this conversation, depending on what Bregman's decision is, and the Red Sox as well, if they are indeed willing to move Rafael Devers. Although Alex Cora yesterday was pretty much like, why are people talking about Rafael Devers moving to first base? Now, maybe Alex Cora has a good poker face and, you know, they've already been talking about that. But I don't know. I'm still skeptical that Devers would end up moving to first base at this stage, but I could be wrong there. And then maybe there are other teams. And I think the quote from Joel Wolf today was that it's more teams than you would think, you know, have asked about Arenado, and maybe that means there's more teams that you would think that he would be willing to go to. I don't know. It's the early stages of that, but the fact that he could be on the move again, and the fact that he won more postseason games with the Rockies than he did with the Cardinals, is one game, is a pretty shocking reality for this player who, you know, was, you could argue, is, right, a future Hall of Famer. So it's a very interesting career arc that his next chapter, where he is going to hopefully, you know, try and go win a little bit more than he has so far, is going to be pretty interesting.
Wow. That's a crazy stat.
Yeah.
Shouts out Tony Wolters.
That's exactly correct. That game, one of my favorite postseason games of the last however many years, was the Rockies beating the Cubs. So yeah, Arenado is definitely the trade name. We talked about how, like, trades are, that's the fun stuff. And I think Crochet is the other one that we expect to be the biggest name move, but it's just, that is also going to be contingent on the starting pitching market and what happens with Burns and Freeman.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I want to linger on that and then we can take a break. There's no reason for the White Sox to trade Crochet today, because his demand is guaranteed to go up over the course of the winter. Because let's say the Yankees get freed and the Giants get Burns, the Red Sox are going to pay a higher price to get Garrett Crochet than they would today. And so the White Sox are going to hold those chips until the rest of the dominoes fall. So don't expect Crochet to move before those two other frontline guys find teams. I don't think, however, I don't think Sasaki will influence it because it is kind of like a slightly different thing.
I agree with that. I just want to end on this with Arenado because we have these direct quotes and I'm compelled by those. This is what Joe Wolf said about Arenado. He said, "The Cardinals are motivated to trade. Nolan is willing to strongly consider it, but he's not going to go just anywhere. A team, where does he want to go?" This is from Katie Wu of The Athletic. What does Arenado want? Quote, "A team that he thinks is going to win now and consistently for the remainder of his career." So it's what you would expect, but we will definitely learn more about that. And I have to imagine if Bregman does get resolved, that the Arenado thing could get resolved soon after. Let us take a quick break, and when we return, we will run through some of the other moves that happened that we didn't get to on our first Juan Soto Extravaganza podcast. We'll be right back here on Baseball Podcast.
And welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbacast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. We are here in the center of the baseball universe, the Hilton Anatole in Dallas, Texas. What better place than to go around the league? I'm going to throw this into turbo mode and talk about some of the transactions that we did not get to talk about the other day. Let's begin with Tyler O'Neill, Baltimore Orioles, 3 years, $49.5 million. Tyler O'Neill, nicknamed Popeye. He is a walking, talking, slugging, anthropomorphic bicep who just swings so hard all the time. Fascinating fit for the Baltimore Orioles. Jordan, what was your takeaway here?
I mean, it's a good fit. I think they have sort of acknowledged that, it seems like a Santander reunion is unlikely. They had a spot in the outfield and a lot of home runs to replace, and Tyler O'Neill can replace some of those home runs. He is one of the more kind of mercurial, hot and cold players that we have in the sport. He has ridiculous, right-handed power, which is not surprising based on what he looks like. But the strikeouts have continued to come in bulk. And I think what's really interesting
about...
Bulk
is a good word
for him. But I think what's interesting about him the last few years is his speed and defense have declined. He has certainly struggled to stay healthy. Obviously, it's not like Santander was a Gold Glover out there. So, how much... It's not like it's necessarily going to be a downgrade defensively. Maybe it's an upgrade defensively. This is a guy that's won a Gold Glove in the outfield before, and maybe he can return to being a plus defensive outfielder. But that kind of brings him into an Orioles outfield that already includes Colton Cowser and Cedric Mullins. I like the fit, certainly, ballpark-wise, if you are going to be, saying goodbye to Baltimore and moving those left field fences in. I'll say the one part about this, and I'm curious your take on this, is what this means for Heston Kjerstad. Not that this you don't make this move because you got to give, 600 at bats to Heston Kjerstad right away, but that's someone who really has little left to prove in AAA. And that's a left-handed hitter, and that's a guy who already has had some success at the major league level. But I also don't think they're paying Tyler O'Neill this much to platoon with Heston Kjerstad. So I'm curious to see where the Kjerstad at bats kind of come along, and if there's kind of more moving and shaking with this Orioles position player group moving forward.
I think that baseball is volatile, and having too many good players who can play the outfield for you is not a problem. And if O'Neill is disappointing, he will probably still crush lefties. And if he gets hurt, then you'll be fine. I am most compelled that this is the guy who the Orioles chose to go for. He is the first multi-year free agent contract they have handed out since 2018. Now, yes, if he plays well, he could just opt out and go back to the market next year and it won't be a multi-year contract. I don't think this can be it. If their winter is Tyler O'Neill and Nate Eovaldi and one other guy, I'm not particularly... That's not pedal to the metal, as far as I'm concerned.
No.
Especially because Corbin Burns would be going out the door.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I'm fine with this move. I think it could end up being really good. Ultimately, we're still looking at the pitching staff and wondering what the plan is. So those moves are going to dictate how we feel about this offseason, no matter what happens with Tyler O'Neill. So I think it's a fine move. I think it'll be a fun fit. I think you will probably enjoy seeing him play for your childhood team, but there will be a lot of strikeouts along the way, so O's fans, get ready for that. Speaking of strikeouts, the Orioles also signed Gary Sanchez. They needed a backup catcher. Gary Sanchez, actually, let's just lump this together. Gary Sanchez got the same contract, 1 year, $8.5 million. I know Jansen has an option, as Danny Jansen with the Rays. I mean, again, we're talking about one-year deals, so how much should we overanalyze it? But like, Jansen was like, okay, he's the catcher, right? That's the one that you want to get. And Gary Sanchez is like so far off the radar. I mean, he played a little bit with Milwaukee, but it's not like we were considering him like an absolute lock to get a deal of this size. And I am compelled that Jansen, I know how bad, I understand how bad he was after the trade and whatever, but considering his age and considering his track record, I'm pretty amazed that he couldn't get anywhere close to what Kyle Higashioka or even Darno did. And it seems like this is Jansen saying, I am better than I was, and I will re-enter the market next year and try to do a little bit better then.
I'm fascinated by this move just because Gary only started 27 games behind the plate. And so if you're, let's say you bump him to 35, right? Then you're asking Adley to catch 130, 125 games. Like, that feels like a lot, a big jump for him. Now, yes, they have a top prospect, Samuel Basayo, who could come up and take some of those starts maybe. But it just, it's an interesting decision to have Gary be your backup catcher, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I would be curious, maybe they view him more as a DH rotator type, and they might go get another third catcher to be on the roster, but I don't know. Orioles offseason so far, kind of odd.
I would agree. Oh, for odd. Let's talk about the Dodgers. They made two interesting signings, bringing in Michael Conforto, outfielder, on a one-year $17 million deal, and Blake Treinen, keeping Blake Treinen, one of their postseason heroes, in-house, sticking with the bullpen on a two-year $22 million deal. Treinen, that's really not complicated. It seems like he wanted to stay there, and at his age, he wasn't really going to command that much, even though he still was one of the better relievers in the league, so that's kind of a no-brainer. I don't really have much to add about Treinen staying with the Dodgers other than other teams probably could have used Blake Treinen, and now he will be, you know, staying with the Dodgers. But Conforto is far more compelling. This is someone who I kind of identify as one of the more underrated free agents coming into this winter, and when the Dodgers signed him, I'm like, oh, all right, I might be onto something. I mean, this really has a lot of the same things as Teoscar last year. I know that that sounds a little extreme because of how good Teoscar was, but same kind of thing, a guy that was playing in a park where his home numbers were doo-doo, and it's like, all right, dude, you still have some decent underlying numbers. We know what you're capable of in the past. And Conforto showed some really good signs. He had his best season of his career against left-handed pitching. He obviously raked on the road. His hard hit rates, his barrel rates, all of those things were up. And what's most interesting about this decision is not that the Dodgers thought that Michael Conforto was good. It's that, what does this mean for Teoscar, who is still a free agent? Is this their outfield addition? Or is there still room for both of them to be, because Teoscar is going to be commanding a 3-4 year deal for, you know, probably double or triple, you know, what Conforto is signing here. And the Dodgers, not that they are, you know, how they are deciding to allocate the resources. Maybe they just say, great, we'll just have Conforto give us a similar OPS plus in the middle or farther down the lineup. And then we're not going to commit to Teoscar for 4 years and have him locked in one of our corner spots. We'd rather keep the flexibility. When the top of your lineup is as good as it is, you can kind of make these decisions and not get too hard pressed about it, but this would be an interesting choice for them if they do end up letting Teoscar go.
It is easy to forget now, but Conforto just had a better walk year in 24 than Teoscar did with the Mariners in 23.
Well, yeah. I mean, by OPS plus, sure. I mean, again, I think Teoscar's season in Seattle was not as bad as people remember. Like, he struck out an outrageous amount, obviously, right? And he was very bad at home, for sure. But he had like an 850 OPS on the road, and like, he still hit a bunch of homers and still drove in a bunch of runs. So I just think there's reasons to think that Conforto could get back to something that we saw earlier in his career with New York. And now that he's healthy, I mean, again, he's not a great outfielder, but neither is Teoscar. So I think it's a good fit, and I'm excited to see just how good he can be with the Dodgers.
1 year, $17 million for Michael Conforto. Time to boot up the Scobo, the Scott Boris scoreboard, tracking every move, every news nugget, every single thing that happens to Scott Boris this winter. On the Scobo, 1 year, $17 million for Michael Conforto. Big win.
Big win, I think, yes. And certainly, when we boot this up next year, we could really be in good if he parlays this into the 3 year, $60 million next year for sure. I'm fine giving this a win. Tyler O'Neill is also a Scott Boris client. And that's one where I'm also curious where we feel like about that one. Because if you put him in the same, like he kind of occupied an interesting spot in our free agent rankings, Tyler O'Neill. And I don't know, did that deal, the 3 for 49.5, are we considering that a win? Because I'm fine giving Conforto a win because $17 million AAV for him when people seemingly have forgotten that he exists feels pretty good, even though I think he's pretty good. What do you think about O'Neill?
I think O'Neill's a draw.
Okay.
I think O'Neill's a draw.
Yeah, it didn't jump out. Yeah.
The opt-out is good because if he posts this year, then he'll just go to the market next year and get the win deal. But you could have foreseen a higher number than this. And anytime but like the Orioles with the team ending up with the guy, part of me is almost, and this early in the offseason, part of me is almost like maybe there was a bigger number out there. But it's not a loss. This is not a loss.
Right, because it's like, oh, maybe he could have waited for Soto also and then waited for another team that was more desperate for outfield. But not a loss. I'm fine with that. So we add those two. That brings him to, I believe, 10-5-3 on the winter. That is your Scobo update, the Jowo Scobo TBD on whether we will be doing that. Maybe we could judge him on Arenado and Sasaki and all those things later on in the offseason. I think that's it, Jake. We had a couple other minor signings, but I don't have too many Alex Cobb thoughts. I'm going to be honest with you folks. So unless you have things to say about Mike Tauchman or Jordan Romano, I think we can say goodbye.
I'm done.
The next time you hear from us will be a very interesting situation, and I look forward to it. We will not be in Dallas anymore. And Jake will not be in this country. More on that later this week. But thank you to producer Andrew Hartz. Thank you, the listener, for listening to this podcast or watching this podcast. Thank you to anyone who listens to the podcast and have told us so here in Dallas. We appreciate it. And email us at baseballovercast@gmail.com.
Aaron Boone is talking right now, so I kind of want to go watch that.
All right. Bye.